Can you do empathy training through country music? It's perhaps not the key question asked by Labrador, but it is a question asked on Hold the Door for Strangers, one of 2023's earliest contenders for Country Album of the Year. This Philadelphia outfit has made a sympathetic, ragged howl of a country record deeply entwined with the works of Wilco, the Jayhawks, Bill Callahan, and Nico Case. And on top of that, we sat down with Pat King today to talk about the album here on the 2010s.
So, I wanted to start because I read on, you know, the little Bandcamp press release at the bottom of the album that back in 2017 you had a crash, broke various bones, didn't know if you were going to play again. Back in November, I had a bike crash, broke my wrist, fractured my elbow. What is your advice on getting back into music after that, and outside of just physical therapy?
Oh, no way. Yeah, that's crazy. So basically what happened to me was I got into a bike wreck, and it was an injury. I forgot what they called it. It's early in the morning, so I'm trying to remember it, but it was basically like the ball of my elbow shattered. And so that kind of, you know, it burst into a bunch of, you know, like hundreds of pieces or whatever. and then basically the pieces that kind of kept that ball together also fractured. So it was kind of a perfect storm of, you know, just complete, you know, just that whole area of my arm was demolished pretty much. So they pretty much had to replace it all with metal and kind of gave me a heads up. You know, they were like, you know, the goal is to get full mobility of your arm, but you know, we can't make any promises. You know, you just have to really show up and do the work in physical therapy and kind of get there. But, you know, it's really, you know, we can't give you a definite pretty much. So it was pretty devastating news to hear. So I think it was just kind of perseverance and, you know, really kind of not letting myself off the hook and not taking that as a realistic answer, you know, just really, really kind of, you know, being very goal driven and being like, no, I will. I'd been playing in bands for years and years, and it's kind of my version of pickup basketball. You know, it's like the thing, it's the thing I like doing. So, it was kind of non-negotiable for me. I kind of had to, you know, get back at it and write songs. So the first album that is technically a Labrador release, a safe distance from a visit, is pretty much me relearning guitar in a way. So I pretty much, you know, I think I was in the middle of physical therapy, and it was like the folklore goes that it was like a really damp and kind of cold night in Brooklyn. And my wife and I, at the time, we lived in kind of a cramped one bedroom apartment. And I was pretty much sleeping on the couch because, you know, it was pretty painful to kind of sleep in our bed, you know, and kind of, I was not getting any sleep really. And, it was just kind of a really sad existence at that time. So I was like, you know, I couldn't, at the time I only had an electric guitar because, the current lineup of Labrador, our guitar player, Chris Hayes, I've been playing with for years and years, and our drummer, Chris Arena, we had this band called Simpler Times, which was like, kind of like a revved up country band. Like the way we described it was, it was like Flying Burrito Brothers meets Cheap Trick a little bit.
That sounds great.
It was like, yeah, it was kind of like, I don't know, we just wanted to be like this loud rock, like kind of bar band, and we were that, you know, we were that. And and even though we weren't that popular, but we played a lot in Brooklyn. And once this accident happened, our bassist was moving out to LA because he works in film and TV, and this happened, so it was kind of like the final nail in the coffin of ending that band. So when the accident happened, I really didn't have a creative outlet, and it was just kind of like this cold night in this cramped apartment, and I just kind of shot up off the couch and was like, I'm gonna walk like a mile and a half to the nearest guitar center, which was in downtown Brooklyn, by the Barclays Center on Atlantic Center. And I'm going to buy a nylon string guitar, and I'm just going to start writing country songs and like kind of sad folk songs, and just kind of, you know, maybe I'll be a new kind of guitar player after this. So that's kind of the genesis of the project. And it's kind of built from there. I think having that in my mind of, you know, I won't take no for an answer. I'm gonna, you know, figure out a way to play guitar no matter what is kind of my best advice in that situation. It's kind of like if you just kind of keep your goals clear and in the back of your head and kind of have something to work towards, I think that's the best way to kind of pick yourself up out of that depression and really kind of, I don't know, maybe kickstart your therapy in a different way.
Do you feel like it made you a different guitarist? Like, did it change the way or technique in which you play?
Well, I've never been that great a guitar player, but I think I'm better now. Mm. I think because I really kind of had to, it was like, and it sounds dramatic or whatever, but it really was kind of, it was kind of like relearning the language a little bit. It was kind of, you know, nothing was tossed off anymore. It was, I really had to kind of consider every movement when I played something.
Mm. Yeah, you were more conscious of your actual physical motions when before it could just be muscle memory.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was. I took it for granted a little bit, maybe the things I used to be able to get away with in the past, I don't think I could get away with anymore. So I think it was, you know, I really had to work for it.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to go more into the album itself, but before then, you know, kind of playing revved up country, alt country. It feels like alt country is having a bit of a moment over the last couple of years. I know there's some bands that you guys are tangentially connected to through like production and studios, like Swearin, Good Looks, SG Goodman, Orville Peck. It feels like there's a, I don't know if it's a conscious backlash to modern pop country, but it does seem to be a rising tide of artists that are more indebted to, say, Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, or country rock folks as well. I mean, do you have a sense of that within yourself, or is it more, we're just doing what Labrador's doing, doesn't matter?
Well, it's I kind of had a different journey than I think a lot of people had with this kind of music. Mm-hmm. I think the joke is, you know, it's probably countless hard times articles, but I think the joke is like, you know, aging punk gets into country or whatever.
Yeah.
and I think so the first band I was ever in was a straight up old timey string band in high school. And the way I started playing was with this group of kids. We all kind of I think a lot of our parents were into folk, and some of my friends that played in this band, you know, they started playing banjo, upright bass, you know, all acoustic instruments like mandolin and stuff, because they had kind of deadhead parents or deadhead friends, older friends that they kind of looked up to. And so by the time I, you know, went to college and everything and was kind of, you know, being shown underground music or indie rock and stuff like that, I the stuff that I was writing and really familiar with was, bluegrass and folk and stuff. So I think I had always gravitated towards alt country, mm-hmm. First. And then when I realized that it wasn't the coolest thing, I kicked around in a lot of punk bands or really tried to play some sort of combination of the two. Mm-hmm. And I think with this project, that was something that I really wanted to, not shy away from. Like, I wanted to make, really make a conscious effort not to, play too loudly or shy away from making something that I thought was pretty or something mm-hmm. like that. Once we really started going, recording and stuff, it was really refreshing. It was really refreshing to see that it was like, oh, maybe this won't be overlooked. Maybe we could actually play on a bill where there's other alt country bands. Yeah. Like, it's kind of nice, that aren't bands that have been around forever and are kind of on the downward spiral a little bit. Not to speak ill of any bands that would have that trajectory, but it's kind of nice. It's kind of nice that people are here for it. And something, like, love Jason Molina or who the Jayhawks are.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of cool to me.
I mean, the Hard Times articles have a point coming from the punk world. I remember a couple of years ago, I was interviewing a noise rock band and the lead singer had just broken his leg during a show and had...
Was it the Jesus Lizard?
No, it was a band called Whores.
Yeah.
And he was like, look, in my spare time, what I do to like help finance this is I work in manual labor. And he's like, the combination of those things is going to break me eventually. And I'm never going to forget this phrase. He's like, I'm going to turn 45 and I'm going to buy my Jeff Tweedy hat.
Yeah, right.
And he's like, because I'm still going to be able to make music. I'm still going to be able to make things that are emotionally cathartic for myself. But I have to be realistic about what my body can do. I remember watching an interview with Converge of just like how much punishment they put their bodies through in their early 20s and how now, they're in their 40s and 50s of just.
I just saw Converge not too long ago. It was the craziest bill. It was them, Full of Hell, Thou, and Uniform.
Holy shit. And I'm so jealous. Holy shit.
It was insane. But Converge, it was insane to see them, after all these years, just come out and destroy, mm-hmm. Just absolutely destroy. And, with double the energy of any hardcore band I've seen in so long. It's just so refreshing with them. But yeah, anyways, I mean, speaking of Wilco, mm-hmm. I mean, they're kind of, they're like the most important band to me, ever. And a real, real sea change in my life was seeing them, when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. I saw them in a tiny basketball court at Skidmore College when I was like, I think it was the Ghost Is Born tour. Mm-hmm. And I think I was like, 16, 17 or something like that. But it really was like, oh yeah, this is a serious band. This is the band. But I remember seeing like a documentary where their drummer, Glenn Cochi, they play like 3-hour sets or whatever. And he's just such a technical drummer. And I think he just has to jump immediately into an ice bath.
Yeah.
After shows and just lay down. But it's true. We just played two shows over the weekend and I'm still trying to catch up. I'm like, and we're not like Dillinger Escape Plan or anything. We just kind of play our songs. But I don't know.
How's the reaction to the record so far?
It's been really nice. I think, like you were saying, like I think people get it, and it's been a real first kind of first for me in my life as a musician. You know, I've played in a bunch of bands where I've written the songs, and you know, I think like I was saying before, I think kind of not shying away from this kind of stuff and kind of going with my gut instincts on the songs I want to make, you know, it's just really nice to see that you know, the kind of stars are aligning in that way. Not that we're a successful band, but that people are actually like, you know, like, oh, you guys like Neil Young, you like Wilco, that's cool, you know, like, and it's not some sort of like you know, it not preceded by some sort of dad rock joke or something.
I mean, we were just talking about Wilco, so, you know.
yeah. But I think that's kind of, I think people are really apologizing for that now, mm-hmm. and I'm really happy about it.
No, you know, I agree.
I went up to Wilco. I covered Wilco's festival, you know, for Pace magazine, over the summer, and Jeff Tweedy kind of said something about that. He was like, can you guys not fucking call us dad rock? You know, like, he really took people to task about that, and I was like, good on you, Jeff, good on you, you know, be aggro about that.
I mean, that's a larger sea change too, of like dad rock being a kind of pejorative in the mid-2000s, and now a lot of the people using it as a pejorative now may have kids, you know what I mean? So it's like, all right, well, yeah, so what's like, happening?
Well, yeah, and like, and kids in their early 20s love Gaucho. You know, they love
Steely Dan. Yeah, the Dan never goes away. The Dan never goes away.
Yeah. Which I mean, I'm not ashamed in admitting I just don't get Steely Dan at all. But
I wanted to ask about the album proper, and especially a theme I feel like I started to pick up on, especially starting, because it starts with the first track with State Line to Eagleville and talking about this relationship where you kind of felt like you had to break someone's heart to practice. And throughout the album, it feels like there's this recognition of empathy training, becoming a better person, sometimes is at the expense of your own heart or other people's emotions, because you're just not there yet. You had to go through that situation to learn, oh, that hurts, or, oh, I'm hurting this other person. And I was wondering why that theme is so embedded and how you kind of came around to that within these songs.
Yeah, it is. I don't know how old you are, but did you grow up with a Ren and Stimpy?
I'm a little younger than that, but my stepbrother definitely did. My older brother. Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, there was like a fake board game in that show called like Don't Pee on the Electric Fence. And I think it is kind of, I don't know, you kind of describing it that way just made me think of that for some reason, but it's kind of true in a way, you know. I don't know. I feel like, you know, especially with what we've gone through as a collective human race, especially Americans in the last 4 years, mm-hmm. 5 years, you know, we were all kind of put to the test in a way of, you know, really, and maybe this accident, you know, kind of had something to do with that too, kind of kickstarting me thinking about it. But yeah, it's something I think about a lot. I think about, I really try, and something that beats me up, I beat myself up over, is, you know, little interactions maybe where I'm not considerate, or moments in my life where I wasn't, or, you know, really didn't kind of see the 360 picture of a whole relationship, or, you know, where I could have done better, you know, as a friend, or as, you know, a family member, or whatever. And it's something I really think, you know, we should, at least with myself, you know, I shouldn't let myself off the hook. And I think with the sequencing of the record, I think you're really right. I think, especially with that first song, which was the first song I ever wrote for this project. It's the first song on A Safe Distance from a Visit. And we re-recorded it as a band for this record. But it is kind of a song where I'm talking about it's about a specific thing. State Line to Eagleville is a route on the Battenkill River, which is the river that kind of is in between my hometown where I grew up, called, it's Cambridge, New York, which is right by, it's kind of on the border of New York and Vermont. And it's this kind of long river, and a lot of people in my hometown use it as like a tubing route. Mm. You know, they tube down it for the 4th of July, which is like a big popular thing. And people just get, they turn up, they get crazy. They build these giant barges out of like tubes and plywood and bring kegs and shoot off fireworks. It's a real scene. But I was thinking about the last time I did it, where, you know, I think at the time I was living in New York, and I did it, and I saw like a lot of friends of mine who stayed around, and you know, I was just talking to them about, you know, where we were in our lives, and I was just kind of thinking about, you know, that kind of the distance between us, and kind of how you kind of have to, especially maybe in your early 20s or something, you kind of have to be a little selfish to kind of get where you want to go. Mm. in some ways. So I think a lot of what I was thinking about at that time was maybe how hardened I was at that age, or the kind of defensively hardened I was, where I was really pushing people away and not being considerate. Mm-hmm. And including that song on the album was kind of a mistake in a lot of ways, because it wasn't really intended to be in the track list. But when we were when the band finally started gelling, we were playing it live, and it was, we kind of put like a real, we didn't really have any up-tempo songs, and we played that one, and we kind of gave it like a big star kind of bounce to it, and it really broke up our sets nicely. So when we were getting sounds, we actually went up to record in my hometown in a family friend's barn. And so we kind of had to build a studio with Kyle Gilbride, which is kind of like his thing. He, you know, has like a mobile rig and brings it up. So we really had to kind of, you know, learn the room a little bit of this barn and kind of get sounds and stuff. So that was the song that we played to do that. And we did it in one take, and it just felt great. And so we included it, but you know, once the album was sequenced, it kind of was the perfect leadoff track to kind of do exactly what you said. Like it kind of, you know, it sets the pace in where it is kind of like a song looking back on being not so empathetic or being kind of selfish in a way. And then every song that kind of happens after it is, you know, kind of building on that and kind of, you know, softening your edges and kind of, you know, they reveal kind of lessons about, you know, why you need to be considerate and why it's important.
Yeah, and it's funny you say it's kind of a mistake, or not knowing that was originally going to be here, because with the sequencing, it does a really nice bookend with the closing track, the title track, because that feels like holding the door open for strangers. It's like it's a incredibly small kindness, but you have to be intentional about it. And I feel like that's kind of this flip from the opening song where you're admitting you may be a little harder or a little bit more cynical. And this last song is like, but I'm going to try this one small thing and maybe that's the first step.
Yeah. I remember in high school, it was, I got that tag, you know, hold the door for strangers. I got that kind of line because I remember, I had this friend who, you know, he was a little bit older and he was kind of like, he was kind of like the guy we would go to his house, like all my friends and I, we would go to his house and like smoke weed and hang out and listen to, he would turn us on to music. Like I remember listening to like live bootlegs of like Funkadelic or something like that, like really kind of out there stuff for me at the time. And you know, he was like a total like Che Guevara t-shirt kind of character, you know, like watched like independent film, you know, mm-hmm. like played the part of like the high-minded guy. But I remember this one time he was talking about how he would take mushrooms and go to the mall and just hold doors open for strangers because he thought it made him feel really good, I guess, you know, like he was just like, it was the best feeling ever. So I thought about that a lot, you know, just like, I think with psychedelics or whatever, you kind of get this, like, sometimes it really narrows things down and it distills goals or, you know, or emotions in that way. And I think for him, that was like such a aha moment of like, oh yeah, you can just be nice and it feels good. You know? So I mean that song is pretty, you know, it's pretty brutal. You know, the verses are a little more involved than that, and you know, it kind of paints a picture of like of someone who at one time was an asshole and then is kind of atoning for that in some ways because of circumstances that humbled them, you know, to kind of come to that conclusion. But you know, it can be that simple. And I think that's kind of what this record's about in a lot of ways. It's just, you know, everyone's having a bad day. Everyone is, you know, life isn't fair. Just be nice and be good and be considerate you know, maybe it won't be that terrible.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about Dog Chorus, kind of this background lyrics about a cult and escaping it. The thing for me is you mentioned AFT on there, and as a native
ATF.
Yeah, ATF. As a native Texan, I immediately think Waco. You know, that is, you know, the Branch Davidians are kind of embedded, and the Sandoff are kind of embedded in Texas lore and Texas culture. So I just wanted to kind of break that down in terms of what you were thinking as you were writing that and trying to create this kind of post-cult escape, or, you know, if it was based on anything, you know, in reality, whether that's Waco or something else.
Yeah. Yeah. So my wife is really into true crime and
tell her to listen to our podcast.
yeah. And I guess I am too, but we kind of meet in the middle, where she kind of listens to a lot of, you know, kind of straight up murder investigations, stuff like that, where I kind of need like the bigger spectacle,
mm-hmm.
you know, the bigger spectacle stories. So, whenever we do long drives, we listen to the last podcast on the left.
Yep,
that podcast. So, I'm very much interested in like all the alien episodes and stuff like that. But she, you know, we kind of have to settle in the middle. So we listen to like the longer serial killer ones and especially the cult ones. And I think with you know, the way politics is in America now, it's, you know, it's not a it's not a revelation for me to say like it's very cultish and that people are easily duped and into kind of, you know, walking into this, you know, house of cards that could fall down at any minute, and they could realize their lives are entire lies or built around entire lives. So I kind of wanted to make a song. That first verse had been kicking around for a long time, and it's kind of like a typical, like, you know, I'm drunk, I'm outside your house, please let me back in, kind of woe is me love song or country kind of thing. And I just, you know, it had been kicking around for a long time, and it never really worked with a band, and it kind of dirges, and it just didn't have like a lot of movement. So I really wanted to make the second verse kind of make it more interesting. Like, what if this person, you know, what if it isn't that simple? Like, what if it isn't, you know, a person who is kicked out for being, you know, a hopeless drunk or something? What if the person on the other end of the door had escaped the cult first, and this guy is coming, you know, maybe escape the cult later and is coming to, you know, kind of, you know, reconcile with the person they love, or they're, you know, and, you know, kind of telling them that the ATF had come and raided the cult, and the kids aren't safe or something like that. Yeah. I just thought that was the best way to kind of, you know, paint a picture of there's a line in that, where it says, what am I going to do if it's all a lie? And I thought about that a lot, you know, like what do these people think when they have that moment, you know, what are they going to do? You know, what's left, you know, if you build your entire life around this, around worshiping or following some sort of, you know, megalomaniacal figure, narcissist or whatever, you know, what are you going to do to reconcile that? And so that's what that song's about. And I think, it really fit in with that theme of empathy. You know, it's kind of like, you know, will you open your doors to something like that? Will you kind of forgive? Can you forgive something, you know, someone that's maybe, I don't know about you, but, you know, I think we all maybe have members of our family who voted for Trump.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
In some way. So it's like, are you going to talk to those people again? You know, like, how does that work? Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of what that song's about on a grand scale.
Yeah. Completely different topic, because this is maybe the most important question that any country or alt country musician has to ask themselves. When do you monologue? When do you talk sing? Like, I lost my gun. Cause it's important. You have to do it eventually, but you have to do it selectively.
Yeah. No, that's true. I don't know. I think, I mean, for me, I think probably, the most important songwriter, you know, I said maybe the most important band in my life is Wilco, but I think the most important songwriter is John Prine.
Mm-hmm.
I just remember, there was a real, my parents loved him, and, they had his self-titled, which I think is kind of the best debut album of any artist, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just insane how, complete he was as a songwriter with that first album, and hearing like Sam Stone and Hello in there back to back is kind of the blueprint for everything I wanted to be as a songwriter in a lot of ways. But he has this song called Lake Marie, and it's this kind of, it's like three separate vignettes almost. It's such an abstract song in a lot of ways. Like it's he kind of gets out there, but it's a lot, it's talk singing in the verses, and then it has this giant chorus. And so that's kind of what I wanted to model that song after, but we kind of gave the chorus to this one like a little bit of a gospel kind of aspect. So it's kind of like a mixture between, it's true, I feel like every country artist has to do it, like kind of like Flying Burrito Brothers, Hippie Boy, or is that the name of the song? Hippie Boy, the last song on Gilded Palace of Sin. That's a talk song, but Faraway Eyes by the Stones, you know, it's almost like a trope, but yeah, I kind of gave myself the challenge of trying to do that, but I had to try and make it interesting and not, not just do it just to do it. Like I don't know if I'll ever do it again.
check that off the list. Never do it again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but I feel like I don't know. I guess with like popular rock music now, it's rare if people sing, right? Mm-hmm. I feel like that's like, I'm not talking shit, but I feel like a lot of people do their Marquee Smiths, but it's different in country for sure.
Wanted to ask, we've talked a lot about sequencing, and I find it interesting that the center of this album, Guy with the Job, that was obviously one of the big singles coming up of it, and then Runner's Body are back-to-back, because at least my understanding of the lyrics, these are very different perspectives and areas, with Runner's Body being this kind of serial killer tale, and Guy with the Job being, if I'm correct on this, like, St. Peter Angels, like dealing with the jobs of looking through the prayers of the world, but also obviously being a little bit of a metaphor of just shit work in life. And I was wondering how those two perspectives lyrically came up for you, and then also in the sequencing, why they kind of hold the middle of the album down.
I think that's really interesting. I haven't thought about how the narratives of those two kind of connect. To me, they're both separate, contained stories, but I do get that. Like, I understand maybe how, one kind of zooms up to the clouds and the other kind of zooms down to maybe, or, a guy with a job, I wrote that as, I'm a huge Randy Newman fan.
Yeah.
And, God Song, I think is just one of the best songs ever written. And because it really makes you think about, we as humans, we're so self-centered in that way where, why are we the only ones that get to pray? That we know about, why should whoever's answering our prayers help us out when, there's like a weary cardinal, flying in a thunderstorm and getting beaten by heavy drops of rain, why are our problems worse than that? And so for that song, I really wanted to kind of envision almost like Albert Brooks is Defending Your Life, what if these people answering our prayers are like overworked DMV workers or something? Yeah. What if they're, it's just like, I'm trying to get through all this paperwork. I'll process your order soon. Just bear with me, kind of thing. So that song is just kind of like, I guess in context with everything else on the album, it's kind of like, it's kind of going back to my point of like, you know, well, maybe we should all just kind of collectively get through it because, you know, we might be waiting online forever. And that runner's body, I think it was kind of, you know, me trying to do the John Prine thing again, where I really wanted to, you know, write a contained story. Mm-hmm. And it's also inspired by my wife's love of true crime a little bit, where I think there is like a Dateline NBC aspect to it, where it's like the protagonist of the story is romantically involved with a serial killer. And in the beginning, they, you know, police are, you know, pulling bodies out of a park, you know, runners who had mm-hmm. disappeared. And the character is, you know, knows it's their, you know, knows that their partner is responsible for it. And then, I kind of wanted to think about the aftermath of that, you know, of what the person does, you know, when the press stop caring, you know, when they stop, you know, hoarding them at their doorstep. And, you know, when the sensation kind of dies down around, you know, just, when the public stops caring about, you know, a big story like that, mm-hmm. you know, and, I kind of, for that one, I think at the time I'm always listening to folk and country stuff like John Prine and Lucinda Williams and stuff like that. But for a long time, I was, when I was writing, you know, this record, I was listening to stuff like, the Blue Nile. Do you know that band?
Hats is one of my favorite, maybe top five records of all time for me.
Yeah. Same. So, the demos of that song, there are demos of that song where it's very much in that mode where it's, you know, just me making these, you know, amateurish beats. And, I really, you know, before the band got solidified, I was like, wait, what if it's like a alt country version of the Blue Nile or you know, something like that where, and so I was, I think that chorus is definitely, you know, inspired by something, you know, Paul from the Blue Nile would mm-hmm. write, where it's this kind of big sweeping sentimental thing. So, yeah, I think to answer your question in a roundabout way, I don't know how they're really connected, but I think it is kind of like, maybe those songs, and Dog Chorus more than any of the other ones are kind of ones where it's like a magnifying glass on someone else's circumstances rather than, you know, kind of grandstanding about, you know, a larger concept of empathy. It's kind of like reinforcing why you should be empathetic, maybe.
Yeah, it's the, well, John, you saying John Prine kind of narrows it down for me in terms of like, not necessarily that the album has or needs a thesis, but there are themes that pop up, and having three songs that are not explicitly about that thesis, but have three or four characters going through those motions is kind of like, it's like data journalism, right? You can't just throw numbers at people. You have to connect it to an actual physical human being to make people care.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah. And just on another, not trope in a bad way, but like you have to have a body count in a country album, right? Like,
yeah, that's true.
Someone has to. It can be a dog, and then that's really sad, or it can be a serial killer, and that's, you know, a different.
Wait, is I haven't even thought about that. Is there a body count on this record?
You got a serial killer album or a song, so I mean they're pulling bodies out of a park, so yeah,
that's. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You didn't even know it, but you fell in. You had
there,
to.
There are multiple bodies. Yeah. You know, it's not one body.
Yeah. I guess the last thing I wanted to ask was on Guy with the Job, partially because that is, you know, the single that pulled me into the record. But what we were just talking about, of kind of this magnifying glass reinforcing the themes of this album, and the bookends we talked about earlier of the opening and closing track, of this kind of like ragged howl, as I described it, of just like, I am at my limit and I am still trying to be a good person, and you really need to respect that, seemed to be like, you know, an ongoing thing for this album. But like, at the same time, it's kind of like you're saying that to yourself as well, because it's like, I'm at my wit's end, I'm still trying to be empathetic, and like, I'm a little proud of myself right now, but I can't even be proud about it right now because I'm about to like lose my mind.
Oh yeah, I mean, that's just my personality in a nutshell. Yeah. I think all my friends and my wife could tell you that. I feel like I'm just, you know, I don't like, yeah, I just don't let myself off the hook very easily. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think I'm not sure people should. Maybe that's what this record's about. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just me kind of reckoning with of just being empathetic and just thinking that, yeah, I don't know. I guess could you rephrase the question a little bit? I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, you're good. It's just, you know, you have this story where you're kind of outside yourself. You're talking about angels, like you're saying, Albert Brooks and all this stuff. But it's even beyond the empathy of just like trying to be a nice person, of also recognizing when you're at your wit's end, when you're burned out, and you're still trying to be a nice person during that time.
Yeah. I guess I don't know if I've ever I don't think I've arrived there yet.
So maybe this is like aspirational a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, the song Wear It Like a Badge, mm-hmm. which is the one before the last song. It's this kind of long one, and I think that one, there's this kind of bridge before the last chorus where I think that and the last song are kind of the thesis statement of the record in a lot of ways, because in that section I say you know, I want to walk the earth with grace and leave behind a better place and see and be seen in a love we've always chased, and I think that's kind of right. I think that's like if I were to tattoo like a memento style message to myself, you know, like to kind of an aspirational message or something, that would kind of be it. You know, it'd be, I'm always amazed by people who can go through life gracefully. Mm-hmm. And which I can't, like I don't think I do that well. You know, to kind of, you know, be a maybe bit more of like an emotional caretaker you know, foster friendships better or just be a better person. And I think to want to be better and to try to be better is all we can do, really. And there's no shame in it. There's no shame in wanting that goal or to think that that's something worth achieving. And I think that's, I haven't gotten there yet. And I don't think anyone ever does, but you know, I think it's worth pursuing. Yeah.